This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I am Jonathan.
And Romani's present, and I've got allergies, so excuse me.
You've got allergies, and we're recording from my jazz club as well today.
Well, yeah, it's back. If the listeners do hear, it's background music. They're recording right next door here. But nevertheless, we haven't been in studio in quite a while, Jonathan.
We haven't. You've been having a good time.
Nothing much has happened, as far as I'm aware.
Well, stealing the looting is, continues.
But it's
really.
That's not much anymore, right? It's like only 90,000 rand on KFC.
90,000 in KFC, 60 billion at Eskom, something like that. You know, nothing big.
And the people who stole get elected to the Gauteng ANC's NEC.
Oh, well, not only that, we got Gidani Mahlangu, who got also elected to that Exco after being overseeing life as a Dimeni.
Oh, this new dawn is just fantastic. I want Jacob Zuma back.
Some people actually have been saying that, and it is a fair argument.
As I said a few weeks ago, he was on a mission to destroy the ANC. And unfortunately, they took him out before he could. But who knows? Let's see the elections in KZN next year. Hopefully a lot of violence.
If not everyone is dead from election violence, you mean?
What's worse? Having an election or not having an election because everyone's dead? I don't know.
Yeah. Right. So to discuss not really the politics of all of this, but certainly the economics, because the country is in a lot of economic trouble. I think you'd have to be blind to deny that, or an ANC member. And we've got an economist in studio.
No, sorry. Don't demean the blind. Like that's not a disability compared to being an ANC member.
That is blind shaming. You're correct. Indeed. Blind shaming. So we've got an economist in studio this week. A gentleman we've been trying to get into studio for a while. He's a busy man. You hear him a lot on many other platforms, but we've got him exclusively for as long as we want, because we've got the key to the door. Mark Schussler from economist.co.za. As I said, well-known on many platforms. I'm sure you've heard his voice before. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Right, so
I just want to get into it. I want an IMF bailout immediately, so that the IMF can say, you know, you can only steal 20%, not 80%. Do you think that will happen anytime soon?
No, there's a very big reason why it's not going to happen. We actually got some good news stories. We're actually a capitalist nation in the first place, and I don't think people realize this. We've got the 8th biggest pension fund assets in the world in US dollar terms. We're bigger than Germany. It's one of the reasons why the JSE is the 17th biggest stock exchange still out there. And it is really a very big thing if we look at that. And there are 16.5 million accounts that own those pension funds. Now, that doesn't mean people, but it's probably about 12 million people. How I got there is the FSB says there's about 11 million that paid in over the last while, and then there's 920,000 pensioners. And we do know that there's about 4.5 million accounts that are dormant. In other words, person that's lost their job or moved from one job to another. And I think it's around 12 million accounts. So if you've got 12 million people owning this economy, there's a lot of money there. And in GDP terms, it's the fifth largest in the world. And people are always surprised by this because, you know, people haven't thought this through. So they make these statements, I'm going to nationalize, I'm going to do this. Or people say, well, the IMF is going to come bail us out. Now, the IMF has certain rules. If we have a current account deficit, they may still come and bail us out. But the problem is when the IMF comes and bails you out, they're going to say, well, we're going to give you some things that you're going to have to do. You're going to have to clean up the corruption. You're not going to spend that much on state employees, for example. You're not going to give them pay increases. They already get too much. And they'll have a look at your whole economy and they'll give you what you've got to do to fix it.
And damn capitalists.
Yeah, and if you're the real capitalist behind the, I mean, that you know, it's people who are for themselves in many cases in government, if you wish, you know, which is the ultimate thing of capitalism. They're not looking at redistributing to the poor; they're looking at redistributing to themselves, and so they would take that and they'd say, "No, I don't want this." So what you do is you change the rules. Now, at the moment, they've been very kind to us, and they've given us 30% that we can take offshore, and only 25% needs to be in bonds. And that's not a rule that you have to go and take to Parliament. The Minister of Finance or whatever can just change it. It's a regulation. That's now the law is already enacted, so he can change the numbers. So what if I just say, right now, we only have to borrow more money, and all pension funds will be required to have 50% in bonds, and you can only have 10% of that bond money in another country. So 40% has got to be here. You've got a captive audience. Automatically, because it's very similar to our GDP, our pension funds, automatically you can carry 40% debt to GDP. That's what you can do overnight. And if you need to change the rules again, you make it 70%.
Aren't we carrying about 42, 43% currently?
No, it's about 53%, but our pension funds are the biggest holders of that. But we've also got foreigners here. We have private individuals or other you know, forms of mutual funds that are not part of pension, like a unit trust or whatever, that would also have it, and banks. Banks obviously are large holders of bonds because they have money coming in and flowing into their things daily. And so some of that money they put into higher yielding assets. If you look at your normal bank account, you're probably earning 1 or 4 or 5%. Why don't they just keep some of that money? And when the shopkeeper banks the money with them, when you spent it, it's there again. So they keep some of that money constantly at 8, 9% or whatever the yield is in a 1 or 2 year or 10 year bond from government or Eskom. So that's one thing. And there will always be, and there always have been, international people that like the higher yields that the emerging markets bring. So, yes, we'll probably have to change the rules, and the pension funds will, you know, be big investors. But the minute that we do that, then the international investor will again feel a bit more calm, because he'll say, all right, South Africans are still 80% owners of their own bonds. You know, that other 20%, they're not going to, you know, nationalize as debt. They're going to impoverish themselves. If they do that, then, you know, here we are.
Well, what's the straw that breaks the camel's back then?
Well, I think there's...
At which point can you not keep sort of funding your own debt into oblivion? I mean, the government can print money.
The government can print money, and then we have the Venezuela situation or the Zimbabwe situation. But here the government hasn't printed money. I must say the Reserve Bank has been pretty active in managing things. Maybe, you know... people don't like the Reserve Bank, but I think they've been in the whole picture, they've been pretty good. But here's the thing that breaks the camel's back that we don't think of anymore. We've got the wrong politics. Because if 12 million people, adults, are part of the pension fund system, essentially you're saying they're captives. 63% of people in South Africa own their own home. 3 million people stay in RDP homes that would probably like to stay, you know, have them. I've heard very senior government people say that they don't want to live under the trinity of traditional leaders or tin pot dictators. So there's another 1.6 million homes there. If you've ever been to Bushbuck Ridge, you know, that's where Tuscany houses come from. And then Pretoria East copied it and the Italians registered it. And this is a whole story, but there's 40 kilometers of houses there. They're not owned. They've got a permission to occupy. If you take that and you change that to private ownership, you unleash capitalism in a very big way, if you wish. So there's a lot of things that we can do with the assets that we have.
Yeah.
And I think people are more capitalist than you think.
Well, I think people are very capitalist. They just cannot exercise those capitalistic rights, so to speak, due to these serfdoms imposed by the state. But back to the pension funds, just for a moment, that seems to be if the government has its way, that's like unused money, right? So the NHI also is looking at the savings account that Discovery has. It's 40 billion rand. It's just unused. It's just sitting there, right? So you change the Section 25 of the Constitution and they say, we'll only take unused property. So that's unused land, unused funds. We will determine what unused means. So it's like medical aid savings or pension funds. It's just sitting there in an account. It's unused. The revolution requires these funds, you know, to, I don't know, help the oppressed or something like that. That is the problem with the expropriation, that compensation thing that no one's talking about.
I think let's take a step back and slightly back in history, if you wish. If I was Eugene de Blanche, I would love Julius Malema. I would absolutely say he's my child. Because he wants to take away from black people. Because who do you think the 12 million accounts belong to? There are 3 million white adults.
Yeah.
Even if all of them, which is not true, but all of them had a pension fund account in one way or another, you're still looking at three quarters of some. I've looked at that pension data, and I'm telling you now that it was about 65% black being Indian colored and black in 2015. Every year it changes with about a percent or two. So we're in 2018 now. We're looking at more than two-thirds, 68-69% will be black. The whites are aging. The whites are the older part of the generation in South Africa. So they were drawing that money. Okay. And that was so on. The same with houses. The houses, 730,000 houses in 2016, belong to white people. Africans, and this is just Africans, have over 7 million houses. So if you're going to take the land away, who are you taking away from?
And
the value is also more African.
Indeed, and black South Africans are more often than not debt-free. I think it's 80%, 84% own their property outright without a mortgage.
Yeah, more of them own their property outright. The biggest percentage of a population group that rents is white. So, you know, absolutely, it's the best thing ever. I mean, if I was Eugene de Blanche, I would say, you go, boy. You carry on doing this. And I don't think people have realized this. But when that thing comes out, just think about this. How many people voted for the ANC government in the last general election? 11 million?
11 million, somewhere there.
12 million pension fund accounts. You're going to take that property away? Okay, we've got 9 million people, or we've got 15 million families, or 15 and a half million or whatever, and 9 point something million of them own a home. You want to take their land away?
Yeah, it's for the
revenue. It's
not about facts here. These are hate facts, firstly.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You should go to jail for stating them.
But you've dug your hole so deep. How the hell do you get out of this now? So, you know, that's the irony of everything. And so,
of course,
if you look at the actual numbers, it's a stunning array of things that we have.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go and look at the number of cars, it's doubled. If you look at the number of houses, and you know, if you go and speak to some people individually, even our now Finance Minister Genene, he wants to give people the houses. He wants to have that transfer of property to private enterprise to private individuals. There's a space and point where you can do this.
Yeah.
You know, there's other simpler solutions. It's just how do we sell those solutions? So I think our politicians have been half asleep. They don't understand their electorate. They've been moved so far to the radical left that they haven't understood this. Because here's another thing. If you look at the Credit Suisse wealth report, okay, what African country is higher than South Africa on average wealth?
None. Nigeria, Egypt. None. On average wealth.
Wealth per capita. On median, yes. Then you get Mauritius and Seychelles and Gabon above us. Okay. So we will be one of the more wealthy countries. We're about 34th in their wealth thing, and I don't think they do our houses well. And if we just transfer the RDP and the traditional houses, we'll climb up that chart. If you do it in purchase power parity, my estimate is we'll be about 25th wealthiest nation on earth. You know, if we then look at per capita average, it's in market terms, in the beginning of this year, it was 58th. In purchase power parity terms, it's probably closer to 40. It might be 44. It might be 38, but it's around there.
It's up there.
It's up there, yes. Out of you know, 180 countries, you're in the top quarter, and you're going to take this wealth away. I mean, you've got to be flippin' stupid to do that.
Oh, but you're being very polite. You can say fuck if you want to.
I do, but that's not the point.
But, I mean, that's what I keep trying to say, well, on social media at least. If you give a title deed to someone in an RDP house, you increase their wealth by hundreds of thousands of rands with the flick of a pen. It takes 2 minutes, and you don't have to transfer in the deeds office. It takes 10 days. It costs nothing. The Free Market Foundation.
Virtually nothing,
The Free Market Foundation have been doing thousands of these for the past 25 years. And, you know, Christo Visa and all the big, you know.
Yeah, and Hamman Mashaba and those guys.
They've been doing it for forever and ever and ever. And then people say, oh, yes, but what will happen is those poor people will just get back into debt with a mortgage. I say, good. How else do you get up in the world if you don't have capital?
Well, what does it actually mean? Well, there's a transfer of wealth. That also takes place. So when the parents die, the children have a roof over their head to start off with.
Sure. And they can inherit it. Yes.
They can inherit it. So that's not what many people have in the world today. And if you go and look at other things like electricity and water to those houses, that's also there. So you're not talking of people that don't have those very basic things. We've got that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not hundreds of thousands even, I would argue. It's potentially millions or tens of millions in even the smallest of houses, because the potential that creates for the family for generations to come.
Oh, sure.
You know, the ability, there's this very narrow understanding of how wealth is created in South Africa. So Julius Malema will look at, say, of course, he'll take a white family and he'll go, all right, here's mom and dad and they both have a job and they earn relatively well. And they both drive nice cars, and they have a son and a daughter, and that son and a daughter both went, and one studied engineering and one studied medicine, and all of this stuff seems like it's somehow linked to their race. And he misses the point of the way that they got them through school, for example, was that they took money out their bond, probably. Mm-hmm. The way that they might have funded university was that. The way they funded their own studies to climb their career ladder on their side might have been through borrowing and through assets like a house. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of misunderstanding of that. And look, I think the general milieu at the moment is one of almost, certainly coming from people like the EFF, is one of revenge, where want to get back. We must get back at the people who oppressed us. But as you point out, every single thing you look at, let's take medical aid, for example. There are roughly 7 million people on medical aids. As you say, only 3 million white people in the country, and they're not all on medical aids. Mm. So if you're destroying the medical aid system with NHI, that's probably in the region of 5 million black people you've taken medical aid away from. The assumption that they're just going to be happy with that, the soft bigotry of low expectations, of course. White people want medical aid. Black people don't care whether they have it or not, because, you know, they're less than for some unknown reason. This is the illogical sort of approach.
Yeah, and things haven't been explained. Let's go back and say, why are white people richer? Well, they had that intergenerational wealth transfer, but have we looked at the white people's education? Have we looked at the white people's age? Have we looked at white people's family structures? You know, in South Africa, 52% of our households are female-headed, where children stay.
Yeah.
Then there's also 1 or 2% of male households. So it's single parents are, you know, here at 55-odd percent.
Mm. There's good data from the U.S. to show that single-parent households have battled with almost every single thing across every category. They sort of rank lower.
Exactly.
That's not to say you're a bad person if you're a single parent. I think people miss that. It's not. I'm sure you're trying everything you can. In fact, more than.
It's very simple. You just don't have the time to do your job and look after the child and take care of the house. I mean, it's just impossible.
And there's no chance of a second salary.
Right.
And that's important in the modern world today. And then also, I think what we also don't look at is we don't say, okay, what is the split rural to urban? And in South Africa and most other countries in the world, rural people are generally poorer because they don't make the money. They might have the view, but they don't have the money. Let's put it that way.
That's a trade-off.
That's a trade-off. So why would you want farmland if that's the area that is maybe poorer?
Sure.
And are you trained for farming? You know, all those sort of things that come in. But let's go back to So the median age of white people a little while ago during the census was 38. Indians was 27. Coloured was 23. Blacks was 21. So if you go and look at that, there's a huge difference. There's a 17-year difference. And I said to Pali Lotla, I said, why don't you, you know, say this? Because I was at Free State University saying this. Professor Jonathan Janssen invited me and so on. It didn't go far, but he sort of just looked at this and he said, no, that's true. You know, in those 17 years, you would have at least two or three promotions.
38-year-olds are generally richer than 21-year-olds.
Yeah. So he didn't, you know, so on. But I think that's the problem. You come from a milieu where you say everything was the past's fault.
Yeah.
And therefore, it was white people's fault. And therefore, I don't want to release statistics, son. I'll leave the statistics there. But I won't explain what's the actual thing.
Yeah.
Because if Mr. Julius Malema or whoever takes over and you take the land away, it doesn't age people. It doesn't change the family structure. It doesn't change the education. All those sort of things are still there, and you're not going anywhere.
Your argument reminds me a bit of the gender pay gap argument that's been happening for the past 20 years or so, which has been debunked because basically people make different choices, people have different goals, and that pay gap is justified because on average women work less than men.
Yeah, so they spend less time at work often.
And this is exactly what you're doing for the
South African population. And I think people are scared to look at those things. And I particularly also blame a little bit the academics because I think they
only a little.
But I think the problem is that many of the academics that work with this stuff know that it's there.
Right.
But they don't want to publish it for fear of where they are because they feel I'm in a government institution being paid by a government and that shouldn't go out. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think they're not providing the leadership that academics should also provide because we're paying them to be there and to give us the truth, not to give us what they think we want to hear.
I mean, what does it say about politics in this country where academics are not able to be honest about the real facts about differences in population?
Yeah, you see, I'm not a good politician, but I would say that's the problem. Fear runs a lot of things. And in a country where the minority is always pushed, it becomes a problem. And it's not just the white minority. It is other minorities.
Oh, sure. Well, the black middle class is a minority.
Minority, exactly. And they're also being pushed. So when you go to somebody that's black and you ask them in a survey, what's their salary? They don't actually want to divulge their salary. So we find a lot of people don't tell us their salary. And then we end up with people working for the state that say they earn nothing. You know, 5% of the people working for the state earn nothing. It's the biggest slave driver in the world at the moment is the South African government. And nobody's investigated this. But academics will go and say, but, you know, 4% of people working in agriculture don't earn anything. But if they do that same test to the state, then it's like actually more. So they've got to go and relook at this.
Oh, but it's very simple. So, people are dedicated to the revolution and volunteer their time, you know, 12 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's all volunteers.
Absolutely, but they do want the Wabenzi with it. It's not just time, you know, you've got to pay me in a Wabenzi. So ultimately, that's what you also got to look at. So if you look at some of the stuff in South Africa, you can debunk some of the myths. What I'm saying is our pension fund's the eighth highest in the world. We know our home ownership is in the top 40. It depends on when you measure it, because if you take, for example, Spain had a very high home ownership before 2008. Here in the near the 80%, 78%. It then fell to 68% and then to 62% or something. So we also fell from about 70-odd%. We're now at 63%. But that's son. But the other thing that people didn't notice is that we've got the sixth or seventh most mall space in the world.
Mall space?
Yes.
Oh, if you look at shopping,
Urban Studies says to you. And I've know that, yes, now property companies have a problem. They have had for the last year or two. But take it a few years ago. How many years? It was more than a decade, probably two decades, that property was the best return on the JSE. Mm. So somebody was paying rent there in this thing. That's why it grew so rapidly. And they were making good returns. And you now go to Bushbuck Ridge. You now go to Toyando. You now go to wherever, Alice Russell up at Harley.
Yeah.
And there are malls.
There are.
There are malls.
I noticed that as well.
And these are not small malls. No. And there's somebody buying, because ultimately the retailer is not going to put stock in a shop, and he's not going to rent a shop. And she is not going to be around if, you know, there's no money.
Sure.
And it's not just grant money. I can tell you, yes, grant days are huge in those areas. But, you know, that is maybe 20% of their turnover or 10% of their turnover. The turnover comes from somewhere else.
Sure.
But if you then look at that and you say, how many people have we got? Then you'll find, and this is not a total world thing, but we would have the second most mall space per person employed. And you would have to think back and say, wait a minute. Does that mean that our people, that there's only a few people shopping, but we need so many malls? That wouldn't be the case. So, you know, how unequal is this, are the people that are actually employed? And that's what the guys are also not getting right. So they went for a minimum wage. And when the minimum wage was announced at 3,500, they said, no, it's over the median age. But then the trade unions started complaining, saying, but wait a minute, because the trade unions know that the agreements that they have, and if you go to Labor Research Services, which is partly COSATU funded, you will see that the agreements are all above that. But nobody talks about that, you know. So, you know, whether it is the sectoral determinations, the bargaining council agreements, or the private agreements, that like the Chamber of Mines is not a sign, or firms or whatever, and they monitor over 500 agreements every year so far. At the top end, it was about 1,000. So, if you go and look at this, you say to yourself, but you know, there's something else here, because we've got cars. We've doubled the amount of cars. There's now more than doubled. In 1994, 1995, it was about vehicles was about 5 million vehicles. We're now at 11 million. If you go to cars, actual cars, it was about 3 million, and we're now at 7.5 million, and that's without Buckies. So you say, but you know, there's 9.5 million people in the formal non-agriculture sector. Then these guys must be earning. And if you look at that, the average is over 20,000 rand in those salaries. And we know from the Eskom stuff that they're underestimating those salaries, because Eskom's not telling them about the pension payments they're making on behalf of their employees and the like. So we have a lot of things. So, you know, if you just look at all these stuff, it's starting to show us. And then we look at taxpayers' data, and we look at the pay-as-you-earn data, and that says 7.9 million people, and that would include pensioners, I agree, are earning enough to do pay-as-you-earn. Not fill in the forms, because you only have to fill in the forms at 240 or 300,000 or whatever it is. That says to you that the median, in other words, the person in the middle in the formal sector, cannot be at 4,500 or whatever they dreamt up. Okay. And
higher.
So the administrative data, the real data, is showing them up time and again. And we also know that because I do the pensioners are 900,000, the private pensioners, because the grant guy is not getting enough to do a pay-as-you-earn, all right?
Right.
And the pensioners, ultimately, many of them, the median there that we know, we've got 680,000 of them in a database. We know that they are well below the tax thing. So we know it's at least 7.5 million people. And that's if you assume people are honest with the tax man.
Right.
If people got a few RDP houses that they got their names on, they're renting out a few of them. I don't think they're likely to tell the taxman either that they're making.
God bless those people. Less corruption.
No, absolutely. So if you look at that, the data's coming back and it's saying to you, we shop a lot. We phone a lot. We like cars. We've got pension funds that are the eighth biggest in the world.
And we underreport to SARS.
And we underreport to SARS, which is...
So what's the problem, Mike?
There's no problem in that, you know.
So my question would be, a lot of those things show that we've grown. We've grown. We've improved. We've got a population that's become economically involved.
And we probably started from a higher base than we thought we had in 94.
Perhaps. In fact, almost certainly we started from a higher base than we thought we had, because we excluded an entire economy that had to exist.
Yeah.
People still had to trade between themselves, feed themselves, send their kids to schools, etc. So that there was an excluded economy that became an
And there's still parts of it that are excluded, because you can look at the trade in an area where one guy has a sheep and the other guy has a goat.
Yes.
And they're trading, that barter would be excluded. Sure. It's judged, maybe, but it's excluded.
Well, this is the same as stockpiles and all those things, you know, money kept under mattresses.
We don't know the size of the taxi industry.
Some of that, certainly. So some of that points to an improvement. Some things going right. Those numbers are heading in a correct direction. So that's what I want to get to is that seems out of line with the fact that the economic policies of the actual government are horrific, in my opinion. They're not policies of growth. They've never shown growth anywhere in the world. They certainly tend towards socialism. You talked about moving to the far left now, and things like expropriation. The rhetoric, and you know, when they say
we're shooting ourselves in the foot,
when they say we're gonna amend Section 25, that is one way to Cuba, Venezuela, you name it, you name the country. And we don't have the manufacturing prowess like China does to power us out of the chaos that will cause. So why do you think it is that on one side we're managing to make a success as individual citizens in the country? We just get on with it and we do our own stuff. With all the government getting in our way.
Let's go back to apartheid, if I may. Sure. I sat and I did the statistics of trains, and train passenger numbers were not going up. They were going down. And you didn't see all those people move to buses. And yet they claimed there were more people employed and so on. So what was happening? Well, either people were moving to cars or something else, and that something else was taxis. So here taxis are coming in. We did our best to stop them. We had all routes and controlled, and you know, the traffic policeman with his grade 8 was there stopping people and so on. Yet the industry flourished. And if you go and look at the sales of minibuses, not all minibuses are taxis, I understand that, but has been rocketing. And if you look at that, it says to you, despite the government's intervention, and despite us telling the farmers, you no more subsidies, let's go back into the new era. We say no subsidies for you. We've taken everything but 4 cents of the diesel away that they get sponsored with a bit. We don't even give them help during times of drought. Yet they're succeeding. People make a plan. It's the wonder of technology and the ability of people. If you go back to Schumpeter and creative destruction, which is what I did in my master's degree, and conductive cycle and everything, people make a plan. And you can't always make a plan because but if we unleash this growth of this economy, the government gets out of the economy, the government transfers a lot more land to private individuals.
And then it flies even more.
It flies even more. And then we will go to where the rest of the emerging markets are, at 5-7% growth, not at the 1-1.5% growth that we are at now, and not saying that any growth is 100% measured, you know, like P.J. O'Rourke says, you know, nobody's got the American dollar economy into the nearest billion, you know, since 1900.
It's interesting to me that, you know, there's no one ever says, well, we're an emerging economy, how do we become not an emerging economy? How do we go from where Australia was in the 70s? Seen at the same level as Brazil, seen at the same level as South Africa, seen, you know, and now it's seen as just another first world nation. It's, you know, Australia, America, United Kingdom, Europe, they're all kind of in there together.
You know, there's a lot to be said in South Africa for certain parts of our economy. I don't think there's as sophisticated financial markets in many, many first world countries. Look at your medical insurance, look at your pension, look at our banking sector. It's certainly innovative. Mm. It's certainly going places.
Our banking's incredible. I don't know if you've ever tried to do any kind of banking in the United States.
No.
You have to write a check.
You have to write a check. No, they live in the 40s. It's unbelievable how backwards the Americans are.
In Germany, there's still very, very small banks. And it's actually quite nice in a way, you know.
Yeah. But they're not linked to anyone
else.
They're
not linked to anybody
else. You've got to go to a small town to the garage.
Yeah, or they are linked via the Spark Hustle because you get a card. But the guy knows you sort of some, but it's not very sophisticated.
Mm.
And, you know, the products that you get through the bank here, from insurance right through to the credit card, which you would get in Germany in that little bank too, but, you know, the home loan, a lot of other stuff, you don't get in all these things. So it's a very more sophisticated market. And I would suggest that it's probably in the top 20. It might not be number one. I think you'll find a Singapore or so might be a bit further advanced. You go and look at our stock exchange, it's definitely further advanced. But in a way, just to go at the taxi guys must be the best consumer service. He doesn't care about you in the car, stuff you. He stops exactly where the customer wants him to stop. And he picks the customer up exactly where the customer is. He was Uber before Uber. So, you know, if you actually look at that free market enterprise that is taxis, it's been an amazing thing. And it says to you that they are more expensive than buses. They are more expensive than trains.
Yeah.
But people migrate to them.
Yeah.
As soon as they get some money. Yeah. And it makes sense. And once from taxis, you migrate to cars.
Yeah.
And maybe first or second or
third
hand
car. And I would suggest
if
the taxis were a bit more free market, if they weren't such a cartel. So if they weren't sort of set routes and they were able to diversify a bit in that. So a guy could decide, well, actually, I'm not going to drive from Soweto to Park Station and then Park Station to Sandton. I'm just going to drive from Soweto to Sandton. Because you can't do that route currently.
Rules, you know, yeah. If you go and look at American taxis, you have to get a license or a
medallion in
the UK, and you go and do all these tests that you know everything backwards. So, you know, to them, son, and I think that next step, Uber is probably liberating a lot of people. But, I mean, you see people take taxis everywhere now. And I think, yes, it's probably cartelish, but I don't think it's complete, because otherwise we wouldn't have that underlying violence probably, because people are trying to move into other people's territory.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a Wild West maybe scenario. But how many rules do we want to replace it with? You know,
less rules.
Well, we want obviously health and safety rules. We don't want the guy driving with a spanner as a steering wheel. You know, we want some. Why not?
Yeah.
Well, I think we all agree that we have rules that are needed. Traffic rules would be part of it, because you would have to have a little bit of, you know, sense to everybody drives on the left or the right-hand side, you know, whatever.
Oh, sure.
You know, those are the sort of rules I don't mind. It's the next step of rules that you could argue about.
Yeah.
But then the next one after that becomes really problematic. So, you know, when you take the government into people's lives, I don't have a problem that a government makes traffic rules. I don't have that as a problem. We can all argue about the speed limit, and some of us break it. But I do have a problem when the government says, you know, you may not smoke in your own car. That I think is the wrong sort of rule.
Yeah.
But I can understand the health thing behind it. I used to be a smoker. I'm no longer. But I'm just saying. So, you know, where do you stop those rules is the big thing. So certain rules we all agree on. But, yeah.
Well, to some degree. I mean, basically all I've heard from you, Mike, is that the South African people generally are doing quite well by themselves. The politicians are fucking us over. What I don't understand is, if the politicians wants to steal, I think there's much more to steal in a growing economy, unless I'm wrong. So why wouldn't they want to grow the economy steal more?
The thing is, if you've got somebody that you can blame and that you can show, look at those people, they're so rich and so on, it's easier to steal. It's easier to motivate yourself probably to steal, and it's easier to take it away because you're taking the attention away. But that's
Robin Hood syndrome.
Yeah, but not say everything's going well. Because we've still got a huge unemployment problem.
Sure.
That's where our inequality comes from. So that's where our poverty comes from. So how do we take those people and put them in? Because now we've spoken, when we did this, if I can take it in, we spoke about parts of our economy that are really excellent. We have parts of our economy that are not good.
Hmm.
So in South Africa, I pay one of the highest tax rates in the world. In fact, I would argue that we're about the eighth highest tax burden to GDP in the world today. Our personal income tax burden is was number 11. It's definitely going to number 10. That's what we're saying. And we know Germany and US are coming down. We're probably in the top 10 right now because these are 2015 figures. Our company taxes are the fifth highest burden in the world. And we're in the top 40 with indirect taxes, excise and VAT.
Is there any calculation of tax versus return?
Well,
because I would argue that we're number one then.
Then we're number one because I would agree
in
with
in terms
you.
Of non-return.
Well, here, let me give you why you're right. If we look at the world average, there's 24 kids per teacher. In South Africa, there are 32 kids per teacher. And if it wasn't for the fee-paying schools, it would be 34. And leave out private schools now. Yes. And so on. If I go to the high tax countries, such as like Sweden and those places, there are 14 kids to a teacher. Now, a teacher can intervene and do better. And I would argue that the teachers are better qualified in those other countries. And this is where we fall down. So we have a very big trade union in the SATU.
Yes.
And they play havoc with people's lives. And that's the real scary part, is that we're still blaming the past for what's happening in the present.
Yeah.
When those people that were benefited by the past, by being made teachers in the apartheid era, are still with us, and the people that have come along with them, and they've now taken over very often the teaching departments and decide who's a principal and who isn't. That's first. Then we look at doctors. 1.8 doctors in South Africa per 100,000. The world average is over 5. So, you know, that's a huge indictment on us. And in this case, I would argue that it's sometimes the professionals that are keeping them out. Because what is the Health Professionals Council doing? Why are they not speaking up and saying, we shouldn't have an intake of we've got so many kids that want to become doctors. We all agree on that because we all know people that didn't get into a medical school. We should be saying, but we don't want 1,500 or 1,400 doctors a year. We want 5,000 doctors a year. We want to fix our medical schools to get there and so on. But why is the Health Professionals Council not pointing this out? Well, because they're making better bucks out of it. Same with the accountants. Why can't we have X amount of so on? They only want so many to pass. Bugger that. The same with the lawyers. Bugger that. Who's got the nicest offices in Sandton at the moment?
The lawyers.
The lawyers. And why is that? Because of the Competition Commission. And has that really helped South Africa that the lawyers have a better building?
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, no. You know, the other point about the doctors, and maybe we can get to this giant elephant in the room, is that the health department, the HPCSA, which is essentially just a limb of the health department, a regulatory limb, they do want to increase the number of doctors, but they're not really willing to increase the quality of education first or the capacity of the quality education. So they're not prepared to go to UCT and WITS and say, well, you guys make good doctors, so what we're going to do is we're going to double the amount of money we give you so that you can do that. And then what they're equally not willing to do is they're not willing to, and the health minister has been very blunt on this, the private sector has said that they're willing to train somewhere in the region of 3,000 doctors a year. That would solve a lot of our problems. Mm. But the health minister refuses to allow for private medical schools to exist. Mm. So that's a large part of the issue, and that speaks to a broader issue, which is a lot of the success we've discussed has to do with individuals doing things for themselves, and then that becoming an industry, for example, taxis, and companies doing things for themselves. So be it medical companies, be it mining companies, be it agricultural companies, those are privately owned institutions. And we have this big problem of anything the government touches, really, it's the opposite of the Midas touch. And so we've got Eskom, which is just a catastrophe. And I don't know, you know, I wasn't really engaged in certainly not in economics at this level, early 2000s. But Eskom seemed like at some point it was half a respectable institution. What the hell happened?
I think if you look at our state-owned enterprises in general, I think the people that ended up running them and the boards were appointed by governments. And those guys played very often for their own pockets. It was the ultimate form of capitalism under the guise of socialism and the developmental state. And that's what happened. It's as simple as that, I think, Jonathan. I don't know if...
It's not crony capitalism when you're stealing. Not really capitalism. Because capitalism doesn't
seek to... Crony capitalism is...
Capitalism is agreement between two people where both benefit. Crony capitalism is where you're screwing the one guy over.
Well, crony capitalism is where, I think two people benefit, but the third is the one that's screwed. Because capitalism isn't a situation of just two people. There's a lot of interest groups in capitalism. And I think we've all got to the stage where we recognize that that government has a role to play, whether it's as the jury system in the states and the a prosecuting system or whatever, and the policing or whatever. But where I think we have a very big disagreement is, should government be now still providing electricity?
No.
Maybe, of course not. They need to be the regulator of it. Maybe we need to also, before we just privatize Eskom, split it up, because you don't want a monopoly. A private monopoly and a government monopoly would be both as bad.
It's the same thing. Yeah. But I mean, why doesn't the government just regulate shoes, Mike? Because, not everyone has shoes. Some people have too many. Some don't have any. I think it's really important the government steps in and makes sure that,
everyone has a pair of Nikes.
Everyone has a pair of Nikes. I think it's really important. Wow. Because why is electricity like this weird other commodity that is not the same as any other commodity that the market can provide? Because we know very well the only reason the government keeps the SOEs is to take money from them. The SOEs fund the ANC.
Well, they perhaps did, but I think it's becoming difficult to take money out of the SOEs because there's no money.
They've stolen so many of them.
And,
But that's the whole patronage network. And they keep patronage is a very
but I think it's also an egotistical network. I think some of the people I've met are not necessarily stealing. But they are promoted beyond competence. And they believe, and this was the same in the early 90s. They absolutely believe that they've got this whole thing, that they know everything, and they're there because they son. But if it wasn't for the party political connection, or if it wasn't for nepotism or whatever, they wouldn't be there. So we've had this stuff. I'm quite sure it's true, but there was this rumor that Dudu's daughter or son was running part of SAA and this and that. And I mean, I can imagine that this person was thinking,
I'm doing the important job.
Yeah. So yes, there's definitely stealing, but it's not only stealing. And the problem is right now, when they try to turn these things around, you've got this guy from Eskom, who's still on Twitter and making... I mean, I'm just amazed that this still happens. I mean, how stupid must you be? You're going to be a great case in court, because everything that you say on Twitter is going to be turned around again.
Except that it would have to end up in court. And I think that's one of the areas of concern.
No, I think that's a huge problem.
I mean, even if people haven't stolen, SAA is a good example. There certainly was theft from SAA, and there was that dodgy deal where they were trying to lease the planes instead of buy them direct and all that. Through a sort of shell company. But a large part of what's happened to that organization is just gross incompetence. Yeah. Managing an airline is no small task. It takes huge amounts of skill, a huge amount of understanding of a very specialized industry. And it's very clear that the people who've been at the helm for many years in a row now just haven't known what they're doing at all. But there is no consequence. There is no consequence from the top. We have, 783 counts against a former president, which in my opinion will end up being squashed ultimately, either by pardon or just not make it through court. But we have people who died as a result of a health department screw up. Nothing's happened. There's a cost to the taxpayer, certainly. There's always a cost to the taxpayer. But there's no personal responsibility. And so you can be the guy who ran Eskom into the ground, and you can post stuff on Twitter which is incriminating, frankly incriminating, but yet you don't have to worry because nothing's going to happen to you. It's as if I have you know, Mike, we walk downstairs at the end of this podcast and I stab you in the back and I dispose of the body. And then I go on Twitter and I go, you know, this is what happened to Mark. I killed him and I'd buried him somewhere here in Rivonia. Incredible. And everyone goes, wow, that's terrible. You're a dodgy dude. But nothing then comes of that. That's where we're at.
Now, this is where we've got the thing. If you look at the victims of crime survey, and I'm not saying surveys are 100% correct, but only about 50% of people report a crime.
Sure, but that's that's loss of faith in the justice system.
Yeah, but why do they lose that faith? Because if you look at the next set of numbers, the amount of criminal things reported, only 6% or 7% of them end up in a court case. Okay, I can understand that not everything, you don't want the little boy who put stones in the road to now go to jail. You know, that's not what you want. But ultimately, that's what you're sitting with. And then of those, only half of them are convicted. So you're looking at 3% conviction rate. Maybe that's a bit wrong because obviously some criminals do a lot of cases. But it does say to you that crime pays. And then on top of that, if you then halve it because half of cases aren't reported, it's another thing. And I think what they should be doing is they should be looking and saying to themselves, and you know which cases they do the well at?
Racism cases.
Well, that too, but just think about it. Drugs.
Really? The drug war.
The drug, yeah, when they catch somebody with drugs, they've got you.
Yeah, because it's easy. And you had the drugs or you didn't, and it's against the law.
Yes, and it's not hectic. You know, it's not like chasing cash in transit robbers. Sure. It's not...
Having a dog at the airport smelling a bag, and it's like, oh, we got you.
Yeah, and that is it. And so they're very successful of that. I would like to know how successful we are at murder cases, but they don't distinguish always. And,
well, we're very unsuccessful. I would argue we're probably at 0% conviction of public officials who steal tax money.
Yeah.
I mean, with
I think there's one minister that's now the ex-transport minister that's now got a problem, but it was the e-NATIS system. And obviously there's paperwork and it makes it easier to get that. But yes, that's the problem. So we are, in one sense, lucky that we've got a court system and so on. But how functional is it? So is it part of the problem nowadays? And is it a will problem as well? So we have what everybody calls a Shaun the Sheep. Do they really want to prosecute all these political cases? No, they don't.
Of course not.
And so it's the poor guy. I'll probably tell you, the shoplifting conviction rate is probably 25%. You know, it's higher than the political conviction rate, which is 0%, as you're saying, or very close to
0%. Or the drunk driving rate is quite high, prosecution rate is quite high.
But even there, you know, you can pay a bribe and get away with it. And that's the other irony that we don't always think about, you know, but if your president is corrupt, the guy taking 200 rand off you on the N3 because you're doing 120 in an 80 zone, you know, he doesn't think it's wrong.
Yeah, but 702 says it's the driver's fault for even you know, approaching the car with the bribe.
You know, I tend all to of 702 listen to Ramon. Something else.
I mean, I don't give bribes as a matter of principle, and I know it costs me a lot not to give bribes, but I know many people who think, you know, it's the cost of living in South Africa. It's just, I can either give 200 rand now, or the court process itself is the punishment. The postponements, the lawyers, the things like this, that's the punishment. Not even the process, not even getting convicted.
So here we are. We come with a victim of crime survey. Were you a victim of crime? No, sir, because I don't want to say anything that I was actually the criminal called the bribee.
Yeah.
So even that, you know, says to me how we've fallen if we think about it. And so we don't really have the numbers. But I can tell you now, if we have a 3% conviction rate, it's pretty high.
Okay, Mark. So are we sitting on the edge of a cliff, really? Because
fiscal cliff.
I would argue fiscal cliff is the everything cliff. Because if we fall off that, it's tickets for everything, really. We've got this situation. You've described some positives in the economy, but we've got the government doing everything they can to sort of hamstring this. So we've got these state-owned enterprises that are bankrupt, who provide very important services. So they need to not be bankrupt. Other than SAA, SAA can go. But
we need PRASA to work.
Eskom is actually important. PRASA is actually important. There are
not important.
Well. until the government's willing to let go of their monopoly, they are important. If Eskom decides to shut down tonight, it will take time for a private institution to take that over and supply electricity.
No, but these things won't be sold or taken away. People will just create their own power sources illicitly.
Sure, Ramon, and it will still take me 2 weeks to install solar into my house. I'll have no power for 2 weeks.
Yeah, and the same as everybody will then want power and solar and everything.
And the demand will exceed the supply.
You might be waiting for a few months.
I'm not arguing to close down Eskom overnight. Yeah. I'm just saying it will disappear because people won't use the products.
Oh, yeah.
They will find alternative means, legal or illegal.
I think that's happening already. That's why the consumption of electricity is basically the same now as it was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, because, and also the big guys closed down when the price
The big
up.
Guys closed down and the economy hasn't grown as much as we'd like and all those things.
And we put another 5 million houses on the electricity grid, but they didn't make up for that.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people who have started to move towards alternative measures and have cut down because they listened to Eskom when Eskom said change your light bulbs and do all those things, right?
Stop using electricity.
Stop using our product. We really don't want you to pay us. So what I really want to get at is, okay, we've got a government pushing really hard. My opinion is if they change the Section 25 of the Constitution, you might as well just call it quits. I don't know what you feel on that. But what's going to take us more, what's going to sort of push us either over the cliff or take us away from the cliff?
Okay, can I just say this? I'm not saying we had the best finance ministers in the world, and I'm not saying we have the best central bank in the world.
Uh-huh.
But I think we've been pretty lucky to have at least a bulwark. In other words, there is somebody uncovering some of the corruption or at least checking the books at Treasury and saying every 10 million rand tender now goes through us, we check, and so on. So in certain cases, we've had parts of government that have worked. Otherwise, we wouldn't have lasted this long. That's clear. Right. And I think if we go over the fiscal cliff, I think that's keeping up a lot of the politicians at night. And I think there is a chance that we do that. I know from the salary bill that keeps on climbing, that pushes us there. But I don't think a country just falls over a cliff. I think if you look at a Venezuela, it's been a decline for a long time period. And we've seen Zimbabwe decline for a long time period. We hopefully don't change the constitution. And if we do change the constitution, and even if we don't change the constitution, we don't do anything radical. We have a bit of a history of turning away from cliffs in South Africa or from watches that are going to hit 12 o'clock. That's the one thing we've got on our side. But obviously nothing is sure. And, you know, this is the economist coming out of me and saying, when I forecast, I've got to look at all possibilities. So, yes, we do have that possibility. But the one thing is, I think describing it as a cliff isn't the cliff. You actually, somebody's using a word wrong because it's a drift. It's a drift down because now we've taken VAT to 15%. In 2 years' time, we need to take it to 16%. And we still don't solve the things and we still pay the civil servants and there's still people living a life of luxury in Pretoria or whatever the case may be. And then we take it another step. So it's a slow squeeze and that's what's happened in South Africa. That slow squeeze, to turn that around, it's a big ship. And I think we were very naive, for example, in thinking President Ramaphosa is going to come in, he's going to turn all this stuff around. I think even us economists were naive because you can change the boards. Those boards have got to change the management. The management's got to change the next layer. You've got to have processes in place and turning that around. And having a look at everything that we've seen, there are some positive signs. What we saw yesterday from Eskom, I think, was much more honest than we've seen in a long time. That's certainly true.
As terrible as it was.
As terrible as it was, and they even said, we don't know if this is all. And I think we're going to see a lot more honesty in some of the other, I think, a Denel and a SAA and a Safcol and Transnet.
Petro SA. Petro SA had 16 billion rand loss three years ago that no one talks
and
about.
All our oil reserves.
Yeah.
They've had to make some people unemployed in a part of the Western Cape that relies on them. In Mossel Bay, And that's going to come back and bite some people.
Yeah.
So I think ultimately we're going to have a lot more honesty perhaps going forward. I think
I don't know, Mark.
It's not perfect. I know.
I mean, I understand. We can, you know, you can make cancer grow slower or spread slower. Maybe that's the better apt
maybe
term.
You do chemotherapy.
But you still have cancer. The cancer is the lack of reforms. It's the rigid labor laws.
But don't you think that people that have all these all these pension funds, you know how many people phone me and of all races and say to me, we're glad you're talking about this. You know, I want to know if my pension fund is still safe. And then we're talking about a teacher in the Transkei saying, I want to know. And I said, well, it's guaranteed by the state, but yeah, it might not, and so on. And will I still be able to afford medical? All those things, because they've seen what's happened to the Transnet guys. They've seen what's happened in Zimbabwe. So I think if we can get that sort of leadership and that sort of political party that looks at that side, because let's face it, we are a shareholder capitalist nation if you look at it. If we've got 16 million households and we've got 12 million people that have pension fund shares, 3 million people have unit trusts, it's probably so on. We haven't even spoken, you know, the claimed, and I'm not claiming the people that say we for all women here in BEE, but there's 11.8 million people that are beneficiaries of BEE. Why has nobody fickered them? Why has nobody given them a share certificate? Why has nobody sent them the value of that company's thing? There are 480,000 that do know that. That's mainly the employee shareholder schemes like Kumba. That's very often the community, specific community, where you know what's happening. But somebody else is deciding for you. Now, we've got the chemical union. Now, there's the ultimate capitalist. The two oaks that sat on top of that union that we're all spowing socialism at us and making all lots of nonsense statements and meetings that I attended 2 decades ago, you know, ended up with 4 billion between them. And they've left the unions, but they're still controlling that fund, you know. So ultimately we have that too. And we should maybe just say there must be a clever political party that says we want to make beneficiaries shareholders. That's what we call inclusive capitalism. Let's do it that way. Let's make it shareholder capitalism.
Right.
Let's turn that thinking around.
Rather than beneficiaries, because you sound like people are just giving
beneficiaries
this shit to
you for nothing. Arbitrary. Yeah. Whether I give you, I say, yeah, for our beneficiaries, we give them some bursaries. Do all of them go and study? No. We also provide a little bit of a clinic. Do all of them go and attend that clinic? No, because I'm all over. So I decide for the beneficiaries, and it's a nice PR exercise.
It's a little pet project,
it's
right?
Exactly, and it's stealing.
Of course.
And if you then look at that, then you've got to rethink that. So we've got some building blocks in place. If we do it clever, then people can do that. And I think the majority of people in South Africa that I know, whether it's the petrol attendant or the person that wants a job, they want certain things. They want their own house.
Yes.
They want to have a good income. They want to have a prospect for them and their children. All those sort of things, like the rest of the world wants. So I think this is what's happening. There's a lot of people, the pushback from small people trying their own little business. Ironically, we saw when social grants came in, a lot of the people that were self-employed declined from about 2.5 million to about 1.2 million.
Interesting.
It's now starting to increase again to about 1.4 million.
So people stopped doing their own little thing and just relied on those grants?
It seems like it.
Okay.
So, but now people realize that that isn't all. They've got to do something. And I think that is a turnaround. I'm not saying it's a perfect turnaround.
Sure.
And it's also what message are we spreading, and who owns the media these days? You know, 702, you were making a comment about Prime Media is owned by a trade union that's under very serious problems.
NUM,
and they used to be very relaxed capitalists. I know them, and they are now no longer relaxed capitalists. They're now worried. So the whole thing turned, and you had to look at it differently. Who owns ETV? Well, actually, the people that own ETV, they're in that trade union. They're more shareholders than workers now, because the workers have lost their jobs. So there's less than 100,000 workers, but there's more than some, not shareholders, beneficiaries.
Right.
All right. So if you make them shareholders, HCI, they will know they've got a share. This is what ETV means to you. This is what HCI, this is what the casinos mean to you. And where's that throughput? Where's that see-through? Where's that transparency there?
It's not.
And it's not. And yeah. So if you're clever about this, you turn things around and you say, why? I want to see the church's books. I want to see every church have an annual report and tell me what the bloody pastor gets paid. Oh, by the way, I also want to know what the secretary at the church gets paid. And the trade union should have the same. Oh, and these non-governmental organizations, I want annual reports from them annually. Son, I want the same with the beneficiaries of the BEE deals. I want to know who's getting paid what. Son, must be figured. You can then bring in an admin group or whatever people that then it's their requirement to give a fair value, you know, to get somebody actuary or whatever to give a fair value or an analyst of the company that these people have got a share in, because some of these things aren't even listed.
But
I'm just saying, if we've given all this wealth to people,
yes,
we must make it work.
Of course.
And so what does that say to you? If people want that wealth, that's what they want. They want to ultimately own something.
Sure.
So that is our ultimate defense, is it not?
Do you think that there is a political party that exists that acknowledges that? Because I don't see it.
I don't see much of it. I see a bit of it in COPE. I think the members in the DA that definitely see that,
but not as a forceful message.
I spoke to Bantu Halamisa once, and I said, look, if I was you, I would certainly focus more on the unemployed. You know, that number is growing. And I would make sure to say to the unemployed, we need to get you a job. That's what we need to do. Then people agree with that, you know. And then I say, and then we've got all these shareholders. And they said, but I didn't know we had all these shareholders. So this is where the stuff up comes in. So even if you're at a business school and you're doing a thing at a business school in the Cape, those guys don't know it because they haven't looked at those numbers. They also believe the slogans, and that's the problem. Our academics are also lazy and have believed the slogans and haven't looked at what's actually happening. And it's in the Financial Services Board, or now called the Conduct Authority, annual reports. It is, the comparison comes from the OECD. I've taken Towers, which is a big thing that Riscura did as well, with them, about the emerging markets. Our BEE funds would be listed in the top 100 would be the 10th biggest pension fund in the emerging market on its own. If you take it that it's more than that, in other words, there's Solms Delta, a wine farm, and, you know, companies outside the top 100 and whatever, and everybody claims to be a BEE partner these days, then you're probably looking at 400 billion or so, and that would put you in the top 8 there as well. So why are these people not getting those benefits? Why are the benefits not being felt of BEE? Because the slogans are winning, and because the real information is not there. And partly our real information is not there because it suits the current political party to keep that away from us. And it suits the academics to be lazy. Yeah. And it suits the business leaders to not upset the apple cart and to continue making their money. So it's left to private individuals like me or you to change that thought. And that's how most processes happen.
Yeah, my only concern with some of what you've said is I worry about – you want the data, really. That's what you want, the data to be far more transparent. So we know where everything is, where everything's going, who's getting what, exactly how everyone's participating in the economy. When you say things like everything must be fecund, you know, that's a government process which is completely useless. Maybe not completely useless, but it's seemingly very onerous, very bureaucratic, difficult to do. And it doesn't seem to be very helpful. I don't understand why, if you and I do a few hundred million rand deal between us, how that is in my world. I want to be able to give you a few hundred million rand for whatever service you're giving me, and nobody has to know about that.
Yeah.
Nobody.
No, that's not what I'm saying. But sure. What I am saying, if you are fickering and you are rickering.
Yeah.
Okay. And we all agree that it's got a different reason to it. Maybe it's a tax reason, maybe it's a terrorism reason or whatever. But here's something. We say we're unequal in this world. We say we have wealth inequality. Yet we don't give those people, when we transfer wealth, the wealth to many people. We give it to one or two people to oversee.
Yes. Right.
Okay. And they can claim that it's for all those other people.
Okay.
And we have no requirements.
So you're pushing back against the claim that we've helped thousands or millions of people when in fact we've helped a couple.
Yeah.
And we have no way to verify either claim.
Yeah, we probably have helped, say, 500,000 that are part of the employee schemes and so on. But the other 11.4 million, we've helped very few of them. And we've probably, you know, I've seen very nice reports, and we've given 1,800 bursaries, you know, in the last 20 years from this union.
It's a joke.
It's a joke in the whole process of the money they got. And we've built, you know, another 10 extra houses and a clinic. And we had a dog training course for people. And then we gave them a dishwashing course, you know.
Pottery and yoga sessions as well. It reminds me of the Thomas Sowell quote. It's like the government steals secretly and then gives back a tenth of it extravagantly, right?
Yes.
Like they steal 40 rand and they give you 5 rand back. They say, fuck, aren't you so happy we give you 5 rand back?
And why does nobody talk about it? Because the companies should have thought about this and said, why is this? It's going to come back and bite us every time. So if I was the companies, I would say, I want this to happen. Because if you're saying to me, as a company, I must be registered, I must do this, and then those guys must have a requirements too. It's not just a one-way street. Then otherwise what happens is that those guys come back and they get another set of free shares to the detriment of who? The current shareholders.
Sure.
Who are pensioners. Who are those 12 million people who own our son. So again, we take from black people, if you wish, to give to a few people. So it's theft.
Well, yeah, that's part and parcel of having a state, Mike.
Yeah, but this is the rule that we make, and this is the private sector being very much involved with it.
But it's called redistribution, not theft.
Now there's a kickback and saying, wait a minute, you know, we've done this once before. We don't want to do it a second and a third and a fourth time. Now the Chamber of Mines realizes it. Some other acts are starting to say, but wait a minute, you know, this is my second BEE deal. Yeah. This is not a something and so on. So, you know, some people should start asking questions. So I think not only were our academics, our businessmen were lazy too. They didn't think this through either. They just went along for the ride.
I think
you'll never come across a group of castrated individuals like business leaders in this country.
Yeah.
They will literally go, they went along with apartheid, they go along with the ANC government, they'll go along with socialism. If it becomes communism, they'll go along with that. If we have concentration camps and gulags, they'll go along with that.
They'll provide the fencing the food.
They could care less. They don't give a shit. They have no scruples.
Do care. You know, that's why that's why South African, the 70% of the turnover of the top 100 companies in the JSE is now outside of our borders.
Well,
so they're caring about their way of taking that out. And they have to look for a return for their shareholders.
But here's the thing, shareholders of pension funds,
we're too happy to go along with that as well.
But they're not activists.
I don't have a problem with that.
Money goes where the least resistance is.
Yeah, my point is that I don't have a problem them following basic business principles. My problem is when something clearly corrupt or unethical comes along and across their way, they don't push back against it because they go, this is the state that we have, and this is the way things are.
They also probably feel guilty as well because many of them are still white. So they feel guilty, and those that are very often of another color are sometimes people that are appointed by the party. But we are starting to see another group of people that are pushing back, and that's good to see, especially in the bigger cities. And it will take time, and I think let's see how it goes. You know, I think circles, you know, cycle, you know, conductive cycle is a very long cycle. Some people say it's 54 years. That's what he said now, because people's lives are longer. Some are saying it's 70 years or so. But just think about this. Do you know anybody that is a National Party member at the moment? That ever voted for the National Party?
Martin van Schalkwyk.
He's the last one, perhaps.
He'd be the last one. Martinez, sorry. Yeah.
I can't even remember his name correctly. Yeah, okay. Let's go back. Okay, that's back. That's 20 sort of same, 25 years forward. Are you going to find anybody that ever voted for the ANC? is a question you should ask yourself. So these things turn, and it's exactly this, the pendulum swings. And, you know, the one time it's a commodity boom because there's too few commodities and everybody piles into commodities until it's too much. And the same with this sort of, let's call it broadly socialism, which is actually not socialism in a way, but at universities where everything, you know, is being shouted at and shouted down, they've become their own Nazis. And they're now imploding.
Neo-Marxism.
Neo-Marxism, if you wish. They just call it something else. And
social justice.
Social justice warriors and whatever you... But my point is, it swings.
Yeah.
And in 20 years' time, who's read so-and-so's book? Nobody. Who was a follower of, you know, let's say, you know, let's take Woody Allen as a movie guy. He was top notch in the 70s, everything. When I was a student, you had to watch, you know, the John Cleese, and what is it?
Monty Python.
The Monty Python stuff. You had to listen to it and watch it, and Woody Allen would be part of it. Now Woody Allen is, nobody admits to knowing Woody Allen. You know, it's turned around completely. And yeah, and that might just be entertainment now, but I'm just saying we're going through that pendulum swing with everything. And it is always that.
Yeah.
You know, there was that witch hunt against anything that was left wing in the 50s in America, McCarthyism.
McCarthyism, yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, but in South Africa, we actually need to fight for that pendulum to swing much faster.
We must fight for that, yes.
I have a feeling, you know, people are very complacent here. Mm. Very complacent. Or they corrupt into the system and accept it and help it, you know, encroach more into other people's lives. So, yeah, maybe we need a disruption, as the techies say, in the political space to give a platform to ideas.
Goodness me.
That are dangerous. That like sounds very giving branded. Black people property that is theirs.
Completely
what
dangerous
a disgusting idea.
While I've got you, just a couple more minutes. Do you want to tell everyone who's listening why trade wars are not easy to win, and that's a bad policy on the part of Donald Trump?
It's a very bad policy. If you go back into the history of trade, trade is a percentage of world GDP. Madison's figures, very famous Dutch economist, showed us that it was about 13-14% of GDP before the First World War. After the First World War, trade things started coming in because during the war, obviously, foul ships were torpedoed and the likes. And that led to probably the greatest recession or depression that the world has seen, in at least since the modern era, which is around 1800. So if you make things more expensive, because that's what you're going to do,
yes,
by putting on tariffs and then people turn to your local producers who aren't as efficient, it will lead to higher prices. Higher prices take money away from the poor, more so than the rich. And they also distort the efficiency of any economy, so your returns on shares and so on also start to decline, and it becomes a huge problem for everybody. And I think that's where Mr. Trump's making his biggest mistake, because I think it's not about China or Europe or whatever, but it's about everybody. You know, today China is the manufacturing hub of the world. But America is the services hub and the IT hub of the world. Now, if the guy in China starts saying, all right, you're not doing this for me very nicely, thank you. I'll allow Apple programs in China without you paying any thing back to Apple. And then South Africa says, I'm just using us as an example now, we'll do the same. And then all of a sudden, you know, intellectual property rights will be infringed upon.
What do you make of the argument, because this is an argument pro Trump's policies that I've heard, which would be, okay, well, for example, when Germany imports a car into the United States has said there is no tariff, or there's a very small tariff, there's a 5% tariff that they charge. But when America transports or exports a car from Chevrolet or whatever it is into Germany, they get charged 30%. So Trump is only equalizing the difference. Trump is saying, well, it's not fair that you nail us 30. I know that this is bad economics, but it's not fair that you nail us 30%. We only nail you 5%. We're just equalizing the game.
Okay. Let's first look at the facts here. In broad terms, And I looked a long time ago, and tariffs have actually fallen since then. But if you look at the GATT round, the eighth round of GATT, which started the World Trade Organization, industrial tariffs for industrial countries fell to its lowest level of about 4%. That's what the, you know, in about a 5-year period. So that was then by the end of the 90s. So yes, there are always one or two exceptions, and it might be that German cars or Germany protects its car industry a bit more, as we do. But ultimately, tariffs are so low today, and it's, you know, the world goes around on that. And South Africa is one of those countries that has some strange tariffs too on clothing, and cars. It's 18%, I think.
Electronics as well.
Yeah. So, you know, we don't have much on trucks and buses, for example. So you can buy a 25-seater bus right now for less than R1 million. Imported from China. You know, you could do a little school bus like that. To do that in 3 combis, you know, is going to cost you a heck of a lot more because there's a tariff on combis. So I think we've got to look at that sort of picture that generally the tariffs are lower. There are always exceptions.
Yeah.
And Mr. Trump is probably also right where the Europeans are very good. It's not the tariffs, but the non-tariff barriers. Oh, you've got swine flu. Oh, you've got this. Oh, you've got that.
Yeah, you know, well, that's why Britain wants to leave the EU. There's 1,000,001 regulations.
Yeah.
On everything.
The EU does have a lot of regulations. I think Britain is, though, making a mistake because you want to be part of the bigger picture, and you must try and change that bigger picture. And I also think the World Trade Organization is the one organization of all the UN bodies, if I can call it UN bodies, the IMF, so on, where each country has one vote. And that's why those trade negotiations are so much harder and take so much longer, even to appoint ahead of it. I remember Pascal was a huge thing getting him in. It was also the same with other heads. So each country has a same vote and the same power and those trade negotiations. So how you lead it and how you do it and what you do about it is. But if you are the country if we remove all our tariffs, and yes, our motor industry closes, we lose 34,000 jobs. We lose a few thousand supplying there. But guess what happens? All of a sudden your car prices drop with 20%. Many more people can afford cars. Maybe we become more efficient in other areas and we find other areas to export.
Well, more people can afford cars means you need more mechanics to repair cars.
Yeah, that's right.
As an example,
we might find something that we can export better, like venison, because the Europeans will stop us. You know, we can't compete on their chicken because their product is subsidized to the nth degree, the maize that those things eat, everything like that. And, you know, you can't really – but we might be able to get, say, venison in because they don't have venison. So we might start thinking differently. And I think that's something – for example, now the pig industry has had a huge problem with listeriosis, if I'm saying it correctly. They then lost a lot of sales in South Africa. At least somebody in the Department of Agriculture and Forestry is trying to get them into Singapore and Taiwan, where, you know,
we can poison the Asians.
You can poison Asians now. I don't think so, but they eat a lot of pork, and they haven't got the same restrictions. So I think they're helping there. So I think your worldview is much wider if you focus on the export market than you.
So is Trump maybe pushing back against things that are reasonably unfair, but he's going about it in the wrong fashion?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, somebody that's upsetting all his friends the whole time, I mean, and placating his enemies, I sometimes think he's the best foreign minister that Russia's ever had.
Yeah, but we could have a long debate on this. But
I don't want to dump Trump or something here. I want to say there's certain things that he's doing right, lowering the taxes, and they are seeing tax revenues starting to increase like they did under Reagan.
And specifically corporate taxes was the major lowering.
Yes. And if you look at that, you know, you look at the States, a small company in the States is somebody in South African terms that would have a 25, 30 million turnover. You know, it's really big, or it's even more. And you get a lot of tax benefits. Your tax rate at the max is 15% or something if you're a small company. It might now be lower under. And then you go into South Africa where everybody pays 28%, but we give you off 300,000 rand or in turnover, you know, your first part of it or whatever. It's ridiculous. You cannot compete in that environment. So in that sense, I think he's really making people sit up and take note. On the trade story, really, we are so dependent on trade. You know, this thing, the cell phone, is parts that come from probably 20 countries, 30 countries, and it's the most efficient and best parts that they can find.
Yeah.
The medicine, you just think of all those things. And there are certain protections. You know, in medicine, after 20 years, your IP falls away and some other places. But and I don't agree with IP all the time, but people must have a return. But, you know, IP for musicians is longer. It's 50, 60 years. They still get the IP.
Yeah. Well, Paul McCartney's not rich enough, really.
No, he isn't. And look, great, I love the Beatles, but I'm saying, you know, there's certain rules that could be made easier for everybody, and I want people to get a return. But if you're saying to people that, whose lives depend on medicine, they only get an IP of 20 years, and then it's got to go for everybody because people's lives depend on it. I know music's lives don't depend on it, but it's not that much of a risk those guys are taking, so why can't we have IP for everybody at 20 years? And then let's leave it. You know, trademarks are different because you've got Coke, you put money in it every year, and you do that. That's a different sum. But
not something I've given a lot of thought to.
Yeah, but those are the sort of things that are also discussed at a World Trade Organization level, and we don't always realize the complexities of it. But today, everything that you touch is not made in one country. I don't think the world can live without world trade. And also trade and services become important, whether it's tourism or whether it's accounting services. You know, the guys that come and check our accountants are not people from South Africa, for example.
Yeah. I mean, I think, Jonathan, you and I both agree this is bad Trump.
On the trade, absolutely.
Yes.
It's bad Trump.
Bad Trump. And other than that, he's been pretty good lately. Mike. Well, I don't know about you two. I need to run.
Yeah, I need to get out of here as well. Mark, thank you. You've given us an hour and a half of your time. Really appreciate it.
Really insightful. Really, really insightful. Especially the difference in population, earnings, and things like that. Even I wasn't aware of it. And I thought I was relatively well informed. But it's been quite a revelation. You. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having
really
me.
Appreciate it.
So you can find Mark on Twitter at Mark Schussler. That's S-C-H and then U-S-S-L-E-R. Always some interesting insights, and he pushes some buttons that might get him into trouble one of these days, but so far so good. As always, you can find us on Twitter at Renegade_Report, on Facebook. You can find Ramon at Roman Kabanak, myself at Jonathan_Witt. And if you enjoyed the show, you're welcome to donate on Patreon. We always appreciate it. Thanks so much for listening. Catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.